Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Professor Derek Black, who is the Ernest F. Hollings Chair in Constitutional Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. His areas of expertise include education law and policy, constitutional law, and civil rights. In this month's podcast, Professor Black walks us through how the law and litigation are connected to current debates, including issues of curriculum, school choice, and school funding. We hope you enjoy this month's episode and that you find it useful.
When you think about some of the debates that are happening now over curriculum, so things like the 1619 Project, whether you can teach about gender identity in schools, there was a case in Florida about wokeness, about Governor Ron DeSantis's law against teaching wokeness. And I know this was in a higher ed context, but I'm curious if the court has ever weighed in on any issues involving curriculum. And if there were to be a question like that, what that question might be.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And unfortunately, I'll sort of slice it and dice it a bit, because there really is a huge statutory difference between sex and race on this, for instance. So with Title VI, which sort of governs discrimination based upon race, there's no exemptions. It's not like you can say, well, you can discriminate. You can't discriminate, you know, in admissions, but you can discriminate in curriculum, right? There's no such rule. I mean, that would seem silly. But Title IX, when it was enacted in the 1970s, you know, sex was an incredibly controversial form of equality, ironically enough, right? Sort of coming even after race. And, you know, gender norms and stereotypes and all these sort of things made a lot of Congresspersons uncomfortable. In fact, some of them tried to load it down with sort of more equality, and they thought, well, then people will vote against it if we have more equality in Title IX. But Title IX, putting aside those theatrics, it has got a number of exemptions. So, for instance, single-sex institutions, or at least some of them, are exempted, and curriculum and textbooks are exempted. So, at least when it comes to gender identity or sex, you know, Congress just took the position, we're not taking a position on that. So that's sort of up to the state. So if you were going to challenge, I don't want to use the word wokeness, but maybe that's an easier way to do it. If you were going to challenge one of these anti-woke laws, so to speak, you know, it would be probably a little bit tougher under Title IX than it would be under Title VI. So that's sort of starting grounds on that. So that's part of it. And I'm really asking, what we're really looking at with that line of analysis is, well, is the sort of stripping of that curriculum, or sort of the elimination of that curriculum, does that have a discriminatory effect on students, right? So that would be one line of attack. And, you know, some folks have been thinking about that. There's another line of attack that's really just about free speech. So it's not about discrimination for the students. It's about the, you know, the right to sort of access ideas and say things. And here again, things get a little dicey, right? The state controls the curriculum, and the state hires its employees and can tell them to stay with the party line, so to speak. But of course, the children have free rights, free speech rights as well. And so we have this dichotomy where you can't restrict the students really at all unless they're doing something vulgar or harassing other students. But you can restrict the teachers to a certain extent. Now there was, and because of this sort of weird sort of tension between state controls of curriculum, yet students have this sort of rights of free speech, there was this case involving the removal of called PICO, the removal of books from the library, and it was really, I think it was a split decision, 4-1-4 or something like that. It was not a clean decision, but the bottom line in PICO was that the school board cannot remove books from the library for ideological reasons, right? The argument, the case was they were moving the, you know, sort of progressive or sort of pro-democratic ideas or, you know, whatever, that they were just sort of targeting ideas that they didn't like and removing them. And the court says, look, the library is really the place where children can go and express themselves and get the ideas that they want. It's not for the state to say what is or is not, you know, politically correct, so to speak, or popular. Now, they said they could remove books that were vulgar, you know, age inappropriate, that sort of thing. So you've got this sort of doctrine there that says, you know, kids have the right to an educate, or at least have the right to a library that's not overly censored. The court has not taken a case that involves the classroom itself, right? So there's a distinction between the library and the classroom. You know, I think there's still, however, a couple, there's sort of a third way, and sorry for this long answer, but, you know, it's you know, we're litigating these cases and we're figuring it out. But there's sort of a third line of attack, which is about substantive due process. And this is purely from the teacher's perspective. And it's not taking the position necessarily that teachers can say and do whatever they want to, but that if teachers are going to be punished or criminalized for saying or doing things, it needs to be crystal clear as to what they can and can't say. And so you cannot have a situation in which teachers are guessing as to what's allowed on a daily basis, right? This would harm the teacher, this would harm the students' access to information, it would make for painful painful sort of instruction if teachers can't figure out what's allowed. And so that is a due process argument. And those type of arguments are quite common in the area of free speech. And so the court has tended to say, look, you know, you have this core speech that's protected, and then you have this sort of zone, this sort of buffer zone around it that needs to be protected as well. And that states shouldn't have ambiguous rules. And so that leave teachers to guess as to what's allowed. And that's where the sort of anti-CRT, anti-woke stuff creates a big problem, which is, well, you know, you say we can't teach critical race theory, or you say we can't teach things that make students uncomfortable, or you have to be fair and balanced, whatever. You know, you got these sort of vague concepts. I mean, how does a teacher go about knowing what is or isn't, you know, critical race theory? There's no sort of definition of that. And they also mandate that you have to teach an accurate sort of version of history or something like that. And I actually filed an expert report in Florida that in which I looked at all the reviewers who were reviewing the math. This was the sort of math textbook debacle down there in Florida. But, you know, the reviewers were clearly confused and conflicting with one another, because one reviewer would think, you know, you couldn't even talk about racial disparities without violating the law. And then another one said, no, that's just sort of, you know, math. That's just sort of the factual numbers. And then some of them said, well, I don't know how you can comply with both standards at the same time. Then you had these other individuals that, like, anytime race was mentioned at all, or sex was mentioned, they immediately said, you know, well, you can't talk about race, or you can't talk about, you know, discrimination. So, you know, anyway, you know, so there's this sort of lack of clarity in this anti-woke type of legislation that creates another problem. Where is this all going to pan out? I mean, I think that the due process one is the most compelling, because you can't send conflicting messages to teachers telling them you need to do A on the one hand and B on, you need to do A but not B, but we're not defining what B is, right? And the teacher just can't do his or her job. So I think there's a good chance on that. There's some other folks that sort of interestingly thought about this from a fourth sort of line, which is, well, wait a minute, you know, the state constitutions guarantee students an adequate quality education. You know, Title VI talks about anti-discrimination. And where's the equity, quite honestly, where's the equity for white students here? Because if white students are being stripped of the type of instruction that they need to participate in, you know, 21st century economy, or they're being taught sort of a warped version of history that they might not otherwise get. Well, you're putting those students at a disadvantage too, right? And so, you know, that type of thinking is really trying to flip the script, right? I mean, the sort of argument is, oh, the sort of equity teaching harms white students. And the argument is, well, actually, maybe the absence of equity teaching harms white students more than folks like DeSantis appreciate.
You mentioned a couple times that that teachers and students have free speech rights. I'm curious, when you think about political action, so youth organizing or teachers organizing to try to push back against some of these policies and laws, what kinds of rights do teachers and students have?
That's the key, right? You can say you have free speech all day long, but what's the scope of that free speech? So let's think about the scope. So for students, we have to think about the difference between classroom discussion and hallway discussion, right? Those are rough categories, but the idea being that, you know, teachers can demand that students stay on topic in class, right? They can demand that they not make extraneous comments. So free speech is not unbounded in the classroom. Now, if you're talking about the issue of legislation or the Constitution, whatever, like if the student's opinion relates to the subject matter, then they can't be sort of punished for their opinion. So students have free speech within the context of the conversation that the teacher creates in the classroom. When we leave the classroom, the student has relatively unbounded free speech rights. The only sort of boundaries on the free speech rights of the students are not creating a substantial and material disruption to school, not interfering with the rights of other students, and, you know, not advocating for drug use or using foul language. But as long as they're following those rules of the road, right? Respect other people, don't use foul language or inappropriate language. Then, you know, don't advocate for drugs, which is just sort of a one-off case. Then they can kind of say, don't disrupt school. As long as they stay within that, you know, they can do pretty much what they can say whatever they want to. Now, me saying that and schools honoring it is a different thing. I know some young people down in Florida were pushing the boundaries of using their speech, and that was making the schools uncomfortable. And so there at least were some instances in which schools tried to restrict that speech. I think those schools going too far, but nonetheless, that's sort of the student side of it. The teacher side of it is that the teacher speaks within the boundaries of the rules that the schools set up or the state curriculum sets up. So the teacher's free speech rights in the classroom are actually far narrower than the students in many respects, because they have to follow the company script, right? The state can prescribe what is orthodox, right, in terms of the curriculum. So teachers can have variance within that orthodoxy, but they can't go outside the orthodoxy. Now, when they're on their free time, you know, that's another thing, although there still are morality and other sorts of clauses that are part of teachers' contracts, as you want, you know, people who are good leaders in the classroom or that sort of thing. So That's sort of where we are. You know, teachers have far less free speech at school than students do. Mostly teachers are just, the demand that teachers can make is that you just articulate clearly what the rules are, and then we follow the rules. If you cannot articulate clear rules as to what I'm allowed to say, then that maybe violates my rights. But as long as the rules are clear, the state has a lot of leeway with that.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about vouchers and neo-vouchers. So for listeners who may not be familiar with vouchers or neo-vouchers, or what some might call educational savings accounts, they're essentially a mechanism for state politicians to make public monies intended for K-12 public schools available for families to spend on private schools or other educational services of their choice. So how might the Supreme Court's recent decisions in Carson v. Macon, for example, impact both the growth of voucher policies across states and how they're likely to be designed?
Yeah, so, you know, here's an area where the court is definitely doing mischief, in my opinion. You know, it used to be the case where you couldn't directly fund private education, private religious education. Then in Zelman, you know, about 20 years ago, the court says, well, you're not prohibited from funding, you being the state. The state's not prohibited from funding private religious education. It can do it if it wants to, right? So you may fund it if you want to. And then Carson says, no, actually, you have to fund it, right? So we went from a place where you can't fund it at all to where you can fund it to where you have to fund it, which is astounding change in the law. Now, that doesn't mean all 50 states have to fund private religious education, but rather if you have some type of private school funding, then that funding has to be open to religious organizations as well. That actually was the holding in Espinoza, and Carson goes even a step further. And Carson versus Macon goes, what I would say, a dramatic step further, because the prior cases were really about vouchers, right, or neo-vouchers, the term that you use. You know, it's always been not just my contention. I think the facts of the matter is that Maine does not have a voucher program. Maine, or if you want to call it, Maine has a public education replacement program, right? So that in these rural areas of Maine where the populations are not large enough to support a public high school, that Maine says those local districts can do one of two things. They can either contract with a neighboring public school district to receive their students, or they can pay for the private school tuition of those students to attend a private school. And so, I mean, I call this different than a voucher because it's not really a choice plan, right? Actually, the students have no choice if you think about it. There's no choice to attend the public school in their district because it doesn't exist. And so they're forced to find a replacement in the private sector. Nonetheless, right, the court says, well, you know, who cares what Derek and a bunch of other scholars have to say? We think this is pretty much a voucher program, and so we're going to apply the same rules of Espinoza. I mean, that's problematic. That sort of Carson ruling is pretty problematic for really only two states, maybe three, but, you know, Vermont and Maine, because they had this sort of rural problem. They've been dealing with it for a century through these sort of private tuitioning. But it does move the goalposts a little bit insofar as, of course, saying anytime, right, the state starts engaging in this sort of private choice area, they, no matter how careful they thought they were, they've got to make it open to religious instruction. Now, this is potentially a huge problem on issues of equity that we've been discussing, because a lot of these religious schools have policies that are hostile to LGBTQ youth. And even if they don't have explicit policies, they may have environments, quite honestly, that are hostile to racial minorities and ethnic minorities. So, you know, you're really, what the court has said in Macon is you need to open up your programs to institutions that may not be welcoming of all your students, right? That may create hostile environments for them. Now, the court did not answer the question as to whether the state could enforce anti-discrimination norms against these private schools. I believe the right answer is, of course they can, right? So you may theoretically say, okay, Bangor, you know, Academy, you know, has to be able to participate in Maine's program. But I think Maine could still say, well, that's fine, but Bangor has to abide by our anti-discrimination rules. And if they don't, they get kicked out of the program, not because of their religion, but because of their, you know, refusal to comply with our rules. So hopefully that's the way the law goes. I think, though, that states who are concerned about equity, states that are concerned about discrimination, have to really start to think a lot harder about how they design these private school programs. And I'm not, I am no fan of these programs as a general principle, for a variety of reasons, but if they exist, I think, you know, states have to start, having clear oversight in terms of what they are teaching or not teaching, and sort of articulating, here's what we want to be taught through for these voucher programs. And if you're not going to teach it, you can't participate. And here's how we want students to be treated, right, around equity and fairness. And if you're not going to do it, then we're not going to participate. And hopefully that would resolve the religious discrimination claim. It's really just about, are these religious schools complying with the rules of the road? Unfortunately, very few states thus far have been willing to apply these rules to private schools. In fact, you know, the, part of the premise here is to do away with the rules and send them to the private school system. And that begs a lot of sort of questions about whether the legislatures themselves are engaging in illegitimate activity, which is to take public funds out of the public schools to fund an education system that is not actually open or welcoming to all students. I mean, how is that in line with state constitutional obligations to deliver adequate and equal education to all students? So I think there's lots of problems with where states have been heading. And I can just only hope that they would move towards some of the solutions that I'm raising here.
So while Macon is sort of one side of the spectrum of decisions in terms of improving public education or harming it, there was a recent decision in the North Carolina Supreme Court, in Leandro v. the state of North Carolina, that I think maybe offers some hope for people who are supporters of public education. So for listeners who aren't familiar with the Leandro case, what was the question that was being considered by the court? And then what was the decision that came down, I think, in November?
Yeah, so Leandro versus State of North Carolina involved the authority of the judicial system to secure a remedy to constitutional violations of the right to an adequate education. And the court, in what I said, was one of the most far-reaching consequential decisions in all of school funding and quality litigation, held that that basically a recalcitrant legislature lacked the authority to deny students a remedy, right? That if the legislature would not implement a remedy on its own, that the court could, in effect, take existing funds out of the state treasury, or sort of order the transfer of those resources out of the state treasury to deliver students a remedy. And that's just an enormously important decision, because what we see in so many states are legislatures that just kick the can down the road, or they threaten the legislature, or they threaten the judiciary, which was the case in Kansas and some other states, or they just, you know, they'll pass a remedy for 1 year, or they'll pass half of a remedy. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I always liken these school funding cases to a dance between two partners, right? And the court being, you know, I don't know, the lead dancer. Well, I don't know whether the lead or not, but you know, the court is dancing, and they need a legislature to dance along with it. But what do you do if your dance partner just doesn't want to dance, right? I mean, the judiciary cannot raise taxes. They cannot appropriate taxes. They cannot pass legislation. And the premise in almost all of our cases is we need the legislature to pass taxes, to pass an appropriation, to come up with a remedy, and the court can simply say whether that remedy is or is not constitutional. So this sort of dance partner analogy has been the way things go. What the North Carolina Supreme Court effectively says is, if you refuse to dance, I can dance without you, right? And I'll just get double dance time or something. I don't know. Maybe my analogy is run out now. But we don't need you to play along if you don't want to play along, because the Constitution is the ultimate guide here, and legislature cannot go to war on the Constitution and refuse to come up with a remedy. So it was really far reaching. Now, that's my sort of more robust sort of reading of the case. Now others say, look, you know, this is just, you know, normal stuff. The money was there. There was an established constitutional violation. Of course, a court can order a remedy with funds that are sitting in the state treasury. You know, that, but no court's ever done it like this before. So it really was amazing. And this was a case that had been dragging. I mean, I was a law student when this case was being litigated at the trial level. And I remember the marathon hearings that Judge Manning used to hold. You know, Judge Manning, who was the trial court judge, you know, issued something like four or five different opinions, all of which were in excess of 100 pages over the course of 2 years. But we never got a remedy, right? This has been waiting for so long, and it really just was a special moment in the history of North Carolina for kids to finally have the Supreme Court say they don't have to wait any longer. Now, I don't want to end this on a downer, you know, the Supreme Court is elected in the state of North Carolina. That composition of that court just changed a couple days after that opinion was issued. And look, the election of new judges in North Carolina had nothing to do with Leandro at all. But nonetheless, you know, there's a different crew on there. So I do worry about the long term stability of that case in the state of North Carolina. But no matter what happens in North Carolina, I think that court really fully articulated the roadmap and the really hardcore constitutional principles that these cases have to rest upon. And so I think any state Supreme Court looking at a similar issue moving forward is going to read this North Carolina decision and take it to heart. And hopefully they're not going to be worried about an election that happened after the decision that really had nothing to do with the decision itself. But
it's funny you say you don't want to end on a down, but I want to ask one last question to give you a chance to sort of encourage all of the listeners. So you
rehabilitate myself here. Okay.
That's right. So you've written about a lot of these issues, if not all of these issues, in your book Schoolhouse Burn. So I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for listeners about how they might continue to defend public schools. And what the role of the courts might be and why this is so important.
State house, right? I mean, we spend so much time talking about the United States Supreme Court for good reason on a number of issues. We spend so much time, you know, talking about Congress and a stalemate in Congress and, you know, the flipping of parties. I can tell you when it comes to public education, for the most part, none of that stuff matters at all. What matters is what happens in the state house. And so many people sleep on the state house, which is very easy to do, for instance, when you have a Betsy DeVos, right, as Secretary of Education, they sort of draw all this attention with their nonsense, right? And it's wall-to-wall. You know, you turn on your television, now it's wall-to-wall sort of federal stuff with maybe a dose of DeSantis in between. But, you know, the quality of education, school funding, vouchers, these are state house fights. And that's actually a good thing in many respects, because what I have found is that a lot of the politics that are on TV, a lot of the politics that are part of congressional races and whatnot, those things can very easily fade away, or at least be minimized at the state level. Because these are real people in the state house with real kids who go to public school, right? I mean, most of our states, 90% of the kids and 90% of the adults went to public schools, right? So whatever sort of ideological rhetoric, you know, wins elections on November the 8th doesn't have much to do with people who have wives who are school teachers and husbands who are school teachers or sons who are school teachers and children who are in those schools. And I think what I have found over time is that most people, I not say all, I mean, there's definitely ideologues in there. And there's definitely people who get fat checks from the outside lobbyists. But what I have found is there are good people who believe in public education on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, people on both sides of the aisle operate on some false assumptions about data and false assumption about what works in schools. And so, you know, you got to bring them along. But I do think there are folks who want to do that. And so we just got to get in there and do the hard work and activate people at the grassroots level and, you know, visit committee chairs and call people on the school board and have them call people in their church and have them call their local representative. And I think things can work out.
Thank you, Professor Black, for being on this month's episode. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweets.